Can everyone see my shared screen? Okay. For Karen and Sarah, just acknowledging that we are jumping in the middle of a 13-part thing the Zohar is saying. It's got 13 points it wants to make. And we're on, well, we'll do again kind of five and read through it, which we did last time. But the basic idea is as follows. This is the conclusion of the introduction of the Zohar. And at the conclusion of the Zohar's introduction, it has, sorry, when I said 13, I meant 14 points that it wants to make. That's important because Maimonides had 13 rationalistic rules for living eternally, his 13 principles. And the Zohar, by having 14, is implicitly saying, hey, we are one-upping that idea or incorporating the 13. We're not rejecting this rationalist idea, but we are stating implicitly that it is insufficient, that rationalistic understandings of religion are doomed to failure. And instead of these principles, they have 14 which unfurl or emanate. And so they start with awe and wind up where we are now. Just one thing I'll remind the group. The Zohar's very first, which everything is seen as coming from within that, is supposed to mirror the process of, that basic question the Zohar is always concerned with. How is it that we exist? And what is the place? Like, how did we move from God, an unchanging God, to life? And what is the relationship between our perception, our devotion, our religious practice, and God's creation? What is the relationship between us and God? Are we God? Are we not God? Is God real? Is God a projection? Is life real? Or is it some kind of holographic thing? All of that is at stake. And the very first thing the Zohar says is extremely controversial, which is that awe is the very first principle of religious, the very first thing a person needs to do. And explicitly, awe here means the Hebrew word yirah often means fear. And usually, the way it's thought of is yirah ta'onesh, fear of punishment, is the first level of religious maturity. And then one eventually moves beyond fear of punishment to a place of yirah ta'romimut, awe, moving from fear of God's punishment to a more mature understanding of like awe of the beauty of creation. The Zohar there says awe is good, but fear is bad. So it says something different than the classic religious framing. It says that all fear of punishment is not some stage in the religious maturation of a religious process or even a person. And they might be here, they're directly responding to the Rambam who endorsed that idea. They're saying that fear is not a good reason to serve God. Even as one needs to be very fearful in the Zohar, the great power that people can exercise in the religious practice. But rather, one needs to come to worship because why? Because if you're concerned about fear, you're concerned about you, and that's egoistic and narcissistic. And all religion rooted in fear will ultimately become narcissistic and not transcendent. That's the very first thing the Zohar has got to say, which is a really stark claim. And somehow we've evolved from there to fear, awe, love, etc. And that's to me the fifth of the 14 commandments of the Zohar. So I'm going to just read through this one again because it's particularly beautiful. And then we'll go on to six, seven, and eight. Does that sound okay to people? Questions or comments? That was just a kind of recap or introduction, but it's always good to reframe what it is we're doing. Okay, so the way it will work. Since we're doing a mystical thing, is I'll read and then we'll discuss. Always discuss. Rabbi Comfort, were you going to say something? You looked like you might want to say something. No? Okay. The fifth commandment, it is written, and we're doing it in English. The group voted to do this in English because Aramaic is no one's first language. It is written, but when the Aramaic becomes relevant, we'll note it. Let the water swarm with a swarm of living souls. I have to move you all to see it. This verse contains three commandments: to study Torah, to be fruitful and multiply, and to circumcise on the eighth day, removing the foreskin. Okay, so they're now charting these ideas to the creation itself. Yishritzu amayim sheretz nefesh chaya, let the waters swarm with the swarms of living souls. Already something remarkable is happening. God is creating, but in God creating, the Zohar reorients that this is not about God's creation, but it's about our religious practice. Again, the implicit statement, our religious practice creates the universe. That's a very interesting perspective. That what we do creates the world. It's not just that there's spiritual power to our action. That is interesting, theurgic. You know, we can do magical things. It's the very, all human religion is from a human perspective, right? That's what the Zohar is saying. Right, all of this, all of God's creation is pi'ilu, to speak from you. There's some limit to our understanding. And we need to always be kind of doing the yin-yang of like understanding, but also coming up against the wall of our understanding and submission to something greater than what is possibly understood by any one of us. And so that's live. Okay. Let the water swarm with the swarm of living souls. This verse contains three commandments: to study Torah, be fruitful and multiply, and circumcise on the eighth day, removing the foreskin. Huh? How is that true? So it just says, let the water swarm with the swarm of living souls, seemingly implying, let there be fish. What if fish have to do with studying Torah, being fruitful, multiplier, or a bris? So to study and contemplate Torah, expanding her every day, not letting her be forgotten. I noted last time here that Torah, again, isn't some received tradition one adheres to, but it's a thing that one contributes to, adding insight and novelty, expanding her. So Torah is something just in the description. She is alive and she can be made new and different by our actions. We are part of Torah because she is the, okay, not letting her be forgotten. So that's the other part of it, kind of new, but also studying, memorizing, reciting, passing down the old and new. As is written, let the waters swarm. Torah. Huh? Well, water is compared to Torah. Torah, you know, water comes down from high, fertilizes what's low, causes life and growth, fills the seas. And so we have here the sea of wisdom, the sea of Torah. It's a kind of primordial Torah. And so we understand that when God has life in the water, life in the water is compared to our words of Torah. One should engage in her every day, enhancing one's soul and spirit. When one does that every day, it's important to do every day because every day is like a new creation and every day needs to be made by us. It enhances our soul and spirit. For when a person studies Torah, he is adorned with another holy soul. As is written, with a swarm of nefesh chaya, a nefesh, soul of that soli chaya, living being. When a person does not study Torah, he has no holy soul. Supernal holiness does not rest upon him. When he is engaged with Torah through his murmuring, he attains that living soul, becoming like holy angels. As it is written, bless Hashem, O his angels, those engaged in Torah, called his angels on earth. What is happening here? And I know I'm going through it quickly. I apologize. We are normally a little more deliberative, but since it is a little review. First thing, just basic understanding. Because like when studying the Zohar, you always have to do a zoom out. This is a methodological point. I learned this from Malila Heldad Eshner. Always zoom out when studying the Zohar. They read a verse, and the way she said it, they go on a trip. She was speaking about like a psychedelic experience. But in other words, every time they read a verse, they see there's like visions that are being had. They're probably chanting the verse in a mantra and then seeing what they see in their mind's eye, right? So it's, what do they see? When they see a sea with fish, Yishritzu Hashemayim Shefetz Nevesh Chaya, they see the words of Torah that we speak as the murmurings of the water that the fish make. Do you see? Like when we speak the words of Torah, even right now, if you speak these words, the Zohar is implying, it's self-aware. You're creating fish in the sea because the Torah is the water and the words are the fish. The words are life because we're bringing life to the sea. And so it's the actual audible sound waves are the fish. And the Torah, the background information it exists in the ether here, is the water. That's what they're picturing. That's the zoom out. And if the words are the fish and the Torah is the water, what are we? Wants the Zohar to know. Where do I fit in? Where do you fit in? So that's where it goes on to this holy soul business. Because you could read this in a different way. Yeah. Which is like the judgment-y way, the judgy way. Oh, those who study Torah, good people. They have holy souls. Those who don't study Torah, bad people, no souls. That's not what the Zohar wants to do. That would be the ignorant way to read this. But what it is answering is a profound question. It's saying when we bring life to the water, and by the way, the Torah then has to be a Torah Chayim, a Torah of life, we are doing something and kind of connecting to an internal channel of holiness that brings us in and then up to the Creator, to God. And it says that in a specific way. You may know, how many levels of soul are there in mystical Jewish, classical mystical Jewish thinking? Anyone remember from last time? Karen. Is that four or five you're saying? You're saying four. What are they? I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
I'm thinking of Nefesh, Yetzirah. I don't remember.
Okay, them. Great. So you are, so there are four worlds which are mentioned, right? There's the world of Asiya, this world of physicality and its attendant spirituality, and the world of Yetzirah, formation, thought by the Kabbalists to be a world of emotions, and Briah, a world of thought, and Atzilut, a world of transcendence and unity. And there are five levels of the soul, which overlap oddly and interestingly with these four worlds. How will five fit into four? We would discuss that a different time. But the top two fit into the top. So the five levels of the soul are the nefesh. And people may be familiar with like a lot of different words for soul. There's nefesh, which means body, but it's kind of like the, it's not just physical body. It means like body life force. It's a refutation of the kind of mind-body duality that like pervades, or soul-body duality that pervades Western thinking. Like you have a mind or a soul and you have a body, as if they're two separate things, as if your body, as if your mind is not a physical organ, and as if there's not something, you know, like beyond physicality inherent in all of it. So the nefesh is all that. The ruach, which means wind or spirit, is this kind of transporter soul. I think it's useful to think about it almost like, you know, there's RNA, mRNA, there's like all the different physical things that work in the body. This is like the soul science, as it were. And so the ruach has a specific job, which is to communicate like wind between the earthly soul and a soul which we could be disconnected from, rooted yet higher. But higher here means further in. The move is in the Zohar, right? Through getting to know the Torah and moving in and projecting it out. It's like a dual movement in and out, they're imagining. So the next level after that is neshama, a famous word for soul. And that is often connected in the mystical thinking with thought and wisdom and intelligence. Not knowledge, but with like creativity and new ideas. And then beyond the neshama, there's the chaya, which is like an angelic level of soul. It moves beyond your individual identity and begins to like leave the human realm. And yechida, unity. And a unity is a world of all souls. It's where your soul is no longer you. And you and me and all of us are connected into something much earlier than any of us and much bigger than any of us. And that exists always, at every moment, says the Zohar, in many places, at any time. It's just a question of our own perception, right? So this exists, but how will we make life vibrant? If we study Torah, says the Zohar, what will happen when we study Torah? This is where this passage begins to get beautiful. It's nefesh chaya. You move from, it says, Yisru tzu ha-shamayim, share its nefesh chaya, let it swarm with nefesh, with living beings, chaya. So it says, great, nefesh chaya. If you cause the water to swarm, your soul will ascend and move to an angelic place. You'll become a living angel. Through murmuring, the Yisru tzu is the murmuring. We talked about the Aramaic translation, actually, it's probably the same of both words. Becoming like holy angels. Okay, you become an angel on earth. This is what is written, let birds fly above the earth. Next it says, Yishu tzuvah shemayim sharef nefesh chaya ve'of ye'ofef ala aretz, right? Am I saying that correctly? I'm not looking at a Bible. But then the birds will fly above the land. So when you, they're seeing it not as two distinct actions. God created fish and birds, the classic way. But when we study Torah in this deeply introspective and soulful way, we will cause action below, which will generate birds flying above the earth, referring to this world. We'll become like angels. We're both rooted within and down, but flying above. We become the angels. Regarding that world, we have learned the Blessed Holy One intends to provide them with wings like eagles to roam throughout the world. Side point, the biblical eagles probably weren't eagles. I just read a whole article about this. They're probably some other bird, like Al-Kan Fein Sharim on the wings of eagles and all that. They didn't have eagles in the ancient Near East. And it's actually some kind of vulture, apparently. That just blew my mind. It's with a huge wingspan. But I was picturing like the American bald eagle. But it's not Rocky Mountain National Park where the documents were coming out of. Yeah, so that's not what it was. Didn't know that. Natan Slifkin did the research on that. We could look it up. Anyway, the Zohar might have meant eagles. I don't know. To roam throughout the world. Is there, and they who await Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. This is what is written. Let the waters swarm with a swarm of living souls and the birds fly above the earth. Torah called water, let it swarm. So now the Zohar summarizes the teaching. Torah called water, let it swarm and generate the movement of a living soul. And you, the speaker, drawing her down from the sight of the living being, drawing the soul in. And then this will cause the birds to fly above as plain. Concerning this, David declared, and people know this verse maybe because there are songs set to it, Lev Tahor Birali Elohim, create in me a pure heart, God. That's the quote. You see it's in italics here. And then the Zohar adds, to study Torah. You know, the start of it is we've been created with pure hearts. And so when we exist, what's the manifestation of that pure heart? It's a natural connection to the Torah we study. The study is not external, but the pure heart in us is well calibrated. It's the right word to receive Torah. And then Ruach Nachon Chadesh Bekirbi, renew in me a steadfast spirit. What's important here is the word Ruach Nachon Chadesh, create new in me. So create in me a Ruach Nachon, again, using the word ruach, which is one of the levels of the soul, the intermediary transporter level. So if I study Torah, it will connect me to that which is above, Hadesh, and will bring something new from me, through me. In other words, if I study Torah, I too can be a partner in a new creation of myself, auto-creation. I create my own identity. I inject vitality or chi or force or chiyut, if you're the chassidim, into my own life. I make my life enjoyable and fight the kind of complications of depression and numbness and cynicism that all of us contend with it in different ways through this creative energy that we have. And we're able to create new things, expanding Torah, even. Even through the Torah, okay. I'm going to pause here because that's the end of the fifth commandment. Comments or questions, reactions, reflections?
Well, I just thought about it when you summarized it. It was good to go over this again, that it's actually a two-way street, it seems. We expand Torah, and Torah expands us by giving us a greater level soul. So mm-hmm. it's a kind of nice
There's a parallel to this teaching. It starts with we expand the Torah and ends with the Torah expands us. Anyone else? Does anyone relate to this? Maybe I'll make it does anyone relate to this idea of kind of like holy study, that it causes an expansive creative energy in the universe, but also in us? Is that an experience that is resonating, or is it seeming foreign? I'm seeing yes and no. I don't know if anyone wants to say anything, but just poll the question. Do you know what they're talking about through experience?
When I go to Torah study, there's almost invariably some moment that I can't anticipate where I feel sort of lit up by something I hear and how it makes me think or feel. So there's something in this that I recognize as consistent with my experience of Torah study. But what I was really interested in here was the fish metaphor and how, I was wondering about how the words being fish and the Torah being the water, the words that I'm murmuring, I suppose, because Torah is words too. So Torah could be, the words could be part of the water. It could be ripples of the water. But I was trying to figure out how this sort of relates to the black fire and white fire metaphor.
Yeah, like this is a new metaphor for Torah, fish and water. We're used to black fire and white fire, except fish and water. Fish are the ripplings of our movement in Torah, and Torah is the water itself. I wonder if anyone was swimming when this teaching came out. Okay. And so from there.
I just want to ask Karen another thing. Is this at all parallel? You're an artist. Is this at all parallel to the creative process of, I don't know, creating an art piece where your mind is, I don't know, expressing something, interaction between you and your created piece?
Not exactly, but I turned my video off because I'm actually moving across the room. I want to show you something that I made recently that I was thinking of when I was listening to this. This is actually a series of large printouts of a drash I did on Genesis 1 that when I pasted them down, they got all wrinkly. And when I was listening to you talk about the fish in the water, I realized that these forms very much feel to me like minnows in the general water of the text, which is submerged under the paint.
Hmm. Wow. Wow.
I'll go back to where I was sitting now.
I will add, with the fish metaphor, it occurred to me that looking at the surface, you don't really see fish. I mean, maybe you can, but they're concealed. And so it is a good metaphor for mystical Torah, which is in its jargon, like they consciously attempt to conceal it. But also for us, it's concealed, right? Our own Torah is kind of underwater and we have to like dive down to an in to uncover it. As you speak about the concealed minnows or I don't know what word you use, but yeah. but something that when you go in can be very rich. Okay. Now, the sixth commandment, to be fruitful and multiply. We have discussed this in a kind of spiritual way, but now the Zohar makes it sexual and real. For whoever engages in this causes that river to flow constantly. Its waters never ceasing, and the sea is filled from every direction. Look, says the Zohar, I'll bring you a proof for the radical idea that human beings are partners in creation with God. That's what the Zohar is. That's an idea that many thinkers have said. You know, Heschel said it, and Rabbi Yitz Greenberg said it. Lots of people. They told it to us in Hebrew school when I was like a kid at Temple Beth El of North Belmore. Rabbi Aaron Goldscheider told us it in like Kita Gimel or something, right? I think it's a popular idea. Am I imagining that? It's a popular idea. Partners in creation with God, you know, perfecting the world, tikkun olam, and all the rest. So here the Zohar says, you know what the proof is that we're partners in creation? And by the way, this would be not just human beings, but this would apply to plants and the whole animal kingdom. Largely, is that you can create new life. You know? For whoever engages in this causes that river. Now, I want to acknowledge at the outset a name. Not everyone wants to have children, can have children, etc. So just name, there's a sort of non-modern, non-PC part of this, but we're reading a 13th century mystical text. But the other power is really still quite relevant. So I felt it was worth naming that in case anyone would feel bad or, you know, I'd just name it. It's waters never ceasing and the sea is filled from every direction. Now, the sea here, we already said is the Torah, but the sea is also Shekhinah. I think I'm going to have to go back to the Sfirot chart. Sorry, bring out our favorite chart. And here we have the mystical Godhead. Okay. It's always fun to just create prophecy in a shared PDF. So, if this is God's unknowable will, why does God choose to do anything? And this here is Shekhinah, the indwelling presence of divinity in our world. So Yesod is the phallus here in this masculine top. Again, the right part is usually masculine and the left is feminine in this gendered kind of thinking about it. And Tiferet and Yesod are considered a kind of phallus symbol, and Malchut Shekhinah is a feminine vessel to be filled, is the way they usually talk about it, playing into these classic paradigms of masculinity and femininity, particularly in the mystical tradition. And so what they imagine is that when you engage in procreation, when a person engages in procreation, or perhaps not just people, as I mentioned, so all the divine energy, ideally, is kind of gathered from above. And comes in Yesod and is waiting there to be released into the world. There's all this divine potential of new life, of new creation. So creation didn't happen. This is the thing the Zohar wants to say. Creation didn't happen. Creation continuously happens and will keep happening anew in different ways. It's not old. It's now and then. It's now and in the future. And so when you have children, you're unlocking divine flow and bringing it into the world. That's what they're saying. And so it's not just Torah study. Torah study kind of allows you to soar upward, but actually being part of creative process, as Rabbi Confer mentioned, I wonder if one could even apply it not just to creating children or human beings, but creating ideas for new, like, in other words, it's kind of broad. But here they're making it specific. Okay, we'll go back to the text. Now, new souls are innovated, emerging from that tree. While above, numerous powers increase along with them. As it is written, let the waters swarm with a swarm of living souls, and let birds fly above the earth. This is the holy sealed covenant, a river streaming forth, its waters swelling, swarming with swarms of souls, right? The swarms of souls for that living being. With those souls entering that living being, emerge many birds flying, soaring throughout the world. As a soul emerges into this world, the bird flying forth with this soul from that tree emerges with her. Huh? What happened here? So this is Zohar and his classic cryptic, you know, like head scratching. So don't worry, we're going to unlock it. We always unlock it. Sometimes we succeed. Sometimes we don't. Okay. Anyone, before I offer my kind of interpretation, does anyone have, what is going on here? Anyone have can anyone read this in a plausible way? Great. So you should know that Tiferet, the tree, anytime you see the tree in the Zohar, you're talking about Tiferet, this kind of, but not just Tiferet, you're talking about loving kindness and its counterbalance of chesed and gevura, strict toughness. And Tiferet is the beautiful balance of them, of being external and giving and internal, of being kind and being tough. And Netzach and Hod, and you're talking about eternal victory and long-term thinking and glory, and also gratitude to balance that, and submission, ego and not, doing versus being. The balance of all these kind of different energies in full balance, that's the tree. And the reason that's the tree is because a really beautiful tree is an extremely well-balanced thing. It's got lots of branches flowing off. Just so we get this tree metaphor and make it a little more important. It's got branches flowing in all these different directions with different weights pulling the tree. And some trees bend and some trees don't. But like the trunk in the middle keeps it all together, yeah? As one beautiful whole. But if it's too off balance, it topples, or in the Zohar becomes demonic because we're in that world. Okay. So that's just a comment about the tree. So when you cause the river to flow, right, and you do that again with Torah study, but then here being fruitful and multiplying, new souls are innovated. Right? So Torah causes new chidushe Torah, expands the palace of Torah, but having kids means new souls are created. they come out of that tree above. So these souls are rooted in this high place. It's not a given that our souls are rooted in divinity. That's not obvious. So it needs to be stated. Our souls are rooted in the divine. We take that for granted. Maimonides would not have thought that. He would have thought that's heretical. There's God and there's us. But these new souls emerge from that tree. Because how do you move from God to us? Not through distance, but emanation. While above, numerous powers increase along with them. What are these powers that increase when the souls are created? So as the souls are created, there are these kind of like attendant angels, guardian angels, let's call them, to take popular movie metaphor, right? The Zohar is just working with this idea that when a new soul emerges, this is like the key moment, yes? A new soul emerging out of the divine body to become real, what happens? Well, first there are these angels, which are described as powers. They're very powerful and they increase. So now we have the next take on this verse, because we said three commandments happen in this one verse. The first commandment was about angels. The Torah study creates angels. We become angelic and create angels in the world when we study Torah to bring good and blessing. But now when there's new souls, so that also creates angels in the upper worlds, right? Remember our angels before Ophiel Fevala Aretz, we said, the Zohar said, in this world. Do you remember that? The Zohar said, in this world. The angels are in this world. But here, by distinction, they're rereading the verse. What happens here also happens there. When a new soul is emerging above, angels are created in the upper worlds. And those birds fly above the earth, namely not on earth, not above the earth like in the sky, but above reality, physical reality. This is the Holy Sealed Covenant. Holy Sealed Covenant is always Yesod, is always the phallus. It's always the idea being like, what is covenant? A relationship. When we unlock the blessing flows, and when not, not. It's like a relationship. There can be moments of generosity or charity or interaction, and then there can be moments of withdrawal and anger and separation in this relationship. So this is the Holy Sealed Covenant, a river streaming forth, its water swelling. And here, like, it's a sexual metaphor, yeah? The Holy Sealed Covenant, a river streaming forth. So they're either describing, according to the commentators, like, sex, or they're describing childbirth. One of the two. Depending on which metaphor you want to read, you'll read these words a little differently. It's water swelling, swarming with swarms of souls for that living being. Right? So every human has swarms of souls. What does that mean? So that living being, according to Matt, Daniel Matt, the editor here, Shechina, the divine presence. So the Yishritzua Mayim Sheretz Nefesh Chaya, let the waters swell down below. What is the metaphor now of the fish in the water? The fish in the water are doing what? The fish in the water are, I'm going to take the sexual metaphor because I think it's the right one. Like, what's the Zohar zoom out here? Sorry, it's R-rated today. The Zohar zoom out is the fish in the water are sperm. That's the Zohar zoom out. And with swarms of soul for that living being, when they reach the egg, the female, they create angels above. Because that then caused the divine female, the Shechina, in this world to become impregnated with new souls which are born. This is a mystical description of sex, is what's occurring. Heterosexual sex. Do you see how it's reading it? And then the angels are, But what's the point for that living being, right? So these souls, which are created from this interaction below, are for the sake of the divine presence, which was a big emphasis in Chassidut. That's why the Chassidim added before every commandment, they would say, L'shem yichlu kutsh abrichu shchinte, for the sake of the unity of kutsh abrichu, of Tiferet, and the Shechina. So it was always to do things not for the sake of oneself or ego. This brings us back to number one, awe. But when seeking to connect with that which is beyond, and creative energy beyond human fallibility and limitation and mortality, we always have to be doing things for the sake of something bigger, of the divine in our world. With those souls entering that living being, emerge many birds flying, soaring throughout the world. As a soul emerges into this world, the bird flying forth with the soul from that tree emerges with her. So what happens is the angel descends from heaven when the person is born. And now there are angels in this world. So these divine angels accompany the soul through the mother, or however else children come into being. And these angels emerge in the world with the birth. This is a remarkable little sixth commandment here. Okay. Now we do, I call this part of the Zohar. The Zohar does Pesach. I think this is very parallel to, you know, that section of the Pesach Haggadah. How many plagues exactly happened in the sea? How many angels emerge with each and every soul? Now we're going to do the game, the Midrash game. I'm not actually sure why they do this. So, like, is it just to be rabbinic, or is there a deeper point? So if you want to help, any comments before we go into that game? Game is maybe not the right word, but that mode, Midrash mode. Comments about this teaching, the sixth commandment, and how they derive this from the fish. How many emerge with each and every soul? Two, one on the right and one on the left. Now, this idea finds itself in the Talmud in two places, in Shabbat and I think one other place. People know about this idea of two angels because of the Shalom Aleichem prayer that the mystics instituted on Friday night. It's a fairly new prayer, yeah? And the basic teaching is that there are two angels, a good angel and a bad angel. But if in the Midrashic Talmudic version of it, in Shabbat, if the table is set and the bed is made and whatever else, the house is cleaned for Shabbos. We're messy people, so I always feel a little guilty. We're not clean enough, but we try. If everything's ready for Shabbat in just the right way, so then what happens? The good angel is able to subdue the bad angel, and you have two good angels. That's the teaching. And so the people then sing, right? Shalom, welcome angels, presuming like we did it all right. And so we have two good angels, not just one. I don't know if everyone knows that's the power of the teaching. It's not just that angels are there on Friday night. It's that there are two good angels as opposed to the normal good angel, bad angel. But God forbid, the opposite is also possible. That if a person does the wrong thing, then the bad angel subdues the good angel. And so it's not just a good angel and a bad angel, but they are teenagers. That is to say, they are socially influenced by each other to be good or bad together. And so two on the right, one on the left. If one is virtuous, they protect him, as it's written, for he will order his angels to guard you in all ways. Kim malachav yitzavelach lishmorcha b'chol derachecha. And by the way, some people recite that verse after Shalom Aleichem, probably because of this Zohar and the associations. But if not, they accuse him. So here it has nothing to do with being ready for Shabbat, this version of the teaching. It's just plain virtue. Right? So, but they act together is the point. Now, Rabbi Pinchas said, there are three. So the first thought is how many angels? Two angels. One good, one bad, but they act as a pair. By the way, what does this mean? What it means is that all of us, if you wanted to like psychologize this, I think it's obvious from the text, this is what's intended. All of us have spiritual power, not just physical power, unseen spiritual power, which could be used for good or bad. A good angel and a bad angel. We're all spiritual beings, but spiritual is not only good. There's dark energy too. This is a bit of a Gnostic element in the Zohar. There's some primordial evil that's just always there. There's more to say about that. Scholars have had a lot to say about Gnostic elements of the Zohar. That is the kind of primordial good and bad, as opposed to what people often consider a more Jewish idea of just good. And considering this idea, you know, in kind of intrusion to classic Jewish theology. But here, there's its good and bad. Our actions can either succumb to this kind of Voldemort dark spiritual energy, or the opposite. Yeah. And can capture all of the energy. So even our negative spiritual impulses can be channeled for good, and even our good spiritual impulses can be channeled for bad. Which is, I think, something we all know from living. Yes, there's like a dark side of our good traits, a shadow. And there's utility to our negative traits if used properly. Like you could use anger for great justice. Or you could just become abusive and violent, for example. Maybe that's a bad example. Okay. But Rabbi Pinchas said, and we're moving 13a means we're on 13, Daf 13a of the Zohar. There are three who serve as guardians of the human being. As is written, if he has an angel over him, an advocate, one among a thousand, to vouch for his uprightness. We're going to look at the verse in Job in the Hebrew in a moment. But just so we see it, if he has an angel over him, one, an advocate, the angel is described as an advocate, two, to vouch for his uprightness, three. Let's go to the verse in Job for a second.
So which one of those three is the one among a thousand?
Okay, so you have here.
It's translated differently. Yeah, one advocate against a thousand.
So im yesh alav malach melitz echad minei alef v'hagid la'adam yoshra. Let's read the full thing. Vayachunenu vayomer p'ta'ehu miredet shachat matzati chofer. If he has a malach melitz, an advocate, if a person has an angel, an advocate, echad minei alef, lahagid la'adam yosho, to declare man's uprightness. Human's uprightness. So what's the verse talking about? What's the plain meaning of the verse here? Then he, God, has mercy on him and decrees, redeem him from descending to the pit, for I have obtained his ransom. What does the verse mean?
Well, I guess it's talking about that if we're still talking about angels and Job, that he has some kind of advocate above to keep him from the pit, from dying.
Yes. So it's kind of like the Sodom and Amorah, but the angel version. If a person has one, even one in a thousand angels who are like innocent, this person is good, then that person will have, God will have mercy on that person and save them from descending to the pit. That's the plain sense. Like you only need a little bit of good to subdue a lot of evil. So you actually get why this verse is relevant to them. Yeah. Like why one in a thousand? We're talking about here, like how forces can overcome other forces. Okay. So back here, Rabbi Shimon said, five, since it's written further, then he is gracious to him. And he says, deliver him from descending to the pit. I have found a ransom. Then he is gracious to him, one. And he says, deliver him from descending to the pit, two. Even though he there, you think in the text, it's God, but like it's a capital he, male God in the Svaria, in the JPS, but in the Zohar's understanding of it, who says it? Another angel. And one angel is gracious, and one angel says. So Rabbi Pinchas replied, not so, rather than he, capital H, God is gracious to him, the blessed Holy One alone, for no one but he has the authority. He said to him, who said to who now? Rabbi Shimon said back to Rabbi Pinchas, you has spoken well. What just happened? What just happened is the Zohar two-step. This is the Zohar's favorite move. And we'll probably conclude on this note. Remember, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is the putative author of the Zohar and the greatest mystic. And he had a read of this verse, but Rabbi Pinchas defeated him. Pinchas ben Elazar had a different read. The question is it these angels which a person creates which cause mercy? Rabbi Shimon initially had this teaching which said there are five angels, perhaps corresponding to the five levels of the soul even, and perhaps the three were corresponding to the three levels of the soul. And in Rabbi Shimon's world, you needed all five angels to kind of channel that energy. And so we're kind of talking about like, how many angels does a person have? How many angels does a person interact with? What's the nature of a person's spiritual energy? And Rabbi Pinchas's retort to him, which he ultimately agrees with, is no, the angels are not gracious. God is gracious. God only acts through the angels. You know, we talk about all this theurgy and empowerment, and it could lead us to think that we're the ones through our Torah study or in this teaching through human sexuality, which is even more dangerous, of a teaching which creates divine energy above. It's very empowering. It's like a different kind of sex positivity. But the shadow side of that could be like a kind of ego or selfishness, which could manifest even in the quality of sexual life, the Zohar is saying, but also could become a kind of sinful way of looking at it. And so Rabbi Pinchas is saying that if you think that you cause your angels to bring the kind of mercy and flow from above into the life, that's too much you. And you need to reread that verse as understanding that God does it through God's messengers, the angels. You need to take a step back from how theurgic you just made this teaching, and have more of an element of submission in the teaching itself. And Rabbi Shimon says, you're right. we'll just conclude, read the conclusion of the teaching. Whoever avoids engendering new life diminishes. We'll do that next time. So it's too much to throw away at the end. So the one thing I will say is, I guess what I'll say is I've enjoyed learning with you all today. I hope you appreciated these teachings. The first, just to summarize, a teaching about Torah. Torah, like fish and water, being a kind of stimulant for birds above, for angels and soaring souls to bring protective, hovering, magical, transportive blessing to our world and the life. And then this second teaching that that human procreation, is also another way of reading fish in the water and birds above, that action below stimulates creative energy, not just in this world, but from world beyond this world to emerge and enter anew. All of these kind of an emphasis and then a further emphasis of the possibility of human action being spiritually meaningful and creating new life and energy, either new ideas of Torah, a new spiritual energy, or actual new life. And then at the end, a little bit of a step back or a pause or a hesitation about the fact that any human energy that is meant to cause this great divine needs to come with a dose of humility in recognizing that only God can bring this above and we're just mere mortals. Lest we, you know, suddenly think of ourselves as these empowered demigods, as the Zohar would have us believe from these passages. So that's the conclusion or summary of where we've been today. And it's really poetic and beautiful along the way. Any final comments?
I have a question that maybe arises from that, but also goes back to the very beginning when we were talking about awe. Because what you were saying about the Zohar starting with awe being controversial, I was thinking about the really early morning prayer about awe, Yirat Hashem, or, you know, Reshit Yirat Hashem. And I was wondering, like, is that potentially the kind of beginning of awe that the Zohar, like, how does that prayer and that Yirat Hashem relate to the kind of awe that the Zohar is saying to start with?
Yeah, that prayer is there at the start of the day because the Zohar said that awe is the first principle. It was inserted by the Zoharic school of mystics into the Siddur. So that's how it relates.
Okay. But it also, it makes me think of what you were just saying about this step back at the end of the sixth commandment.
You know. Yeah. You know, it's this dance between recognizing and giving poetic voice to our human power. And then also recognizing that none of it comes from us, that all of it only exists in a kind of great interconnection and unity, and recognizing that and kind of fitting into that spiritual puzzle. So it's like if any branch got too heavy, the tree would fall, you know? So, okay, these will leave us with a lot to think about and consider. And then we'll finish this teaching next time and then get to the next commandment, circumcision, which they're going to derive from the same verse. And also we'll get Elijah's appearance at the circumcision ceremony there, which is, I think, a favorite feature. Like people know about that. There's a chair of Elijah and Elijah is announced, but I think it's shrouded in some mystery for people. Like, what is Elijah doing at the circumcision ceremony? Because we're going to get that. That will be special. Thank you all. Next week, same time.
Thank you.
Thank you.